Economic Commission offers new avenues for expanding bilateral ties between Pakistan and Iran. He noted, in order to increase bilateral trade, both sides are ready to establish barter markets, which will later be made free economic zones to enable investors of both countries to set up their industries for import and export purposes.
I believe that the implementation of these agreements will play a significant role in raising the quality of life of the people of the two sides, especially the border markets, transportation, and the exchange of goods between the two countries.
Islamabad has assured Tehran that it is committed to taking all possible measures to increase bilateral trade volume to the level of $5 billion in near future.
Besides signing different MOUs in the fields of transport, trade, and business, both Pakistan and Iran also stressed the need of making visa conditions easier to facilitate the traders and visitors from both sides. Nasir Kazmi in Islamabad.
North Korea launched two cruise missiles into nearby waters early Wednesday morning, according to South Korean military officials. The missile shots follow South Korean President Yoon Suk-yeol's offer of substantial aid, with one condition. Pyongyang must give up its nuclear weapons program.
We will help the North every way we can. If the country shows us its commitment to complete denuclearization, I think we need to provide an agenda first so that we can wait for its answer. And this will also enable us to have meaningful talks with North Korea in the future for the establishment of peace on the Korean Peninsula.
Some South Koreans view the previous summits between progressive former President Moon Jae-in and North Korean leader Kim Jong-un as empty shows for the cameras. For North Korea, the offer of aid from the conservative new President Yoon suffers from questionable timing.
Coupled with the fact that South Korea and the U.S. are about to stage war games, it seems highly unlikely that North Korea is even going to respond to South Korea's offer. The U.S. and South Korea have not staged field exercises in years, and obviously North Korea is outraged at what's going to happen.
The U.S. and South Korea have been engaging in frequent small-scale military drills since South Korean President Yoon took office. The joint U.S.-South Korea military exercises are scheduled to begin on August 22nd and will be the largest in about 4 years. Pyongyang views the drills as a rehearsal for invasion. This year's maneuvers will include an amphibious landing. The upcoming drills will also involve a U.S. aircraft carrier strike group and strategic weapons. The South's Yoon also said he hoped to strengthen the U.S. extended deterrence commitment to defend South Korea with nuclear weapons. Frank Smith, Seoul.
The sizzling temperatures have cooled off in the UK, but the inflation rate is only heating up. Prices are going up everywhere, as inflation, this time driven by food price hikes, jumps to its highest level since 1982, coming in at more than 10%. Millions of families across Britain are now trying to make their money stretch, but it's getting harder by the day.
My weekly, my monthly, everything's shop is increasing. I'm shopping right now whilst I'm at work to just save time. Because not only is your time money, but we don't really have much of that thing called money.
I am having to budget myself, limit myself, to try and ensure that my wage lasts the whole month, considering I'm having to pay for petrol, bills, rent. It does all add up.
It's harder for me to afford things because, you know, I don't have the steady income like most people do in London.
Economists say the UK is facing a perfect inflation storm caused by a number of factors. Brexit and the delays and disruptions it has caused to the supply chain, the pandemic, and the ongoing Western-backed war in Ukraine. The UK economy reopened suddenly after COVID, creating bottlenecks at ports compounded by post-Brexit red tape, followed by astronomical energy prices resulting from a decision to wean the UK from Russian energy. Inside the UK, that has translated into higher transport and packaging costs, soaring energy and food prices. That means bills getting more and more expensive in supermarkets, restaurants, and gas stations, feeding the demand for higher pay, which adds further to business costs
which turns into even higher prices. And it is that demand for wage increases that's seen multiple public sector strikes in recent weeks. It's a worsening mess that some economists say is in large part the UK government's own doing.
The answer is the war in Ukraine. And you will say, well, is the war in Ukraine going to come to an end? And the answer is no, not if the UK government can help it. You see, Western foreign policy is involved in another debacle.
All this at a time when the UK awaits a new prime minister. Whoever they may be, they have their job cut out for them. Saeed Puriza, London.
A year ago, the United States marked a chaotic end to 20 years of war in Afghanistan, following a hurried pullout of troops that saw the Taliban reclaiming power in the country. Here in Tehran, Iranian officials and political analysts sat together to discuss different aspects of the incident. They regard Washington's exit as an escape from the Afghan quagmire after it failed to achieve its geostrategic objectives there.
Today, the significance of Afghanistan has not diminished in the eyes of the Americans. They didn't leave the country to let China, Russia, and Iran invest in it. The U.S. had to leave because it totally failed there. But it will continue to make the best of its efforts to destabilize Afghanistan.
Last year, in late August, the U.S. evacuated thousands of troops from Afghanistan in just a few days, following President Joe Biden's order to exit fully by August 30, 2021. The withdrawal marked the end of two decades of war in Afghanistan, which sought to bring peace to the country, but left a trail of chaos and mayhem.
The United States not only did not fight terrorism during its two decades of presence in Afghanistan, but had a role in many acts of terrorism to legitimize and prolong its presence there.
1 year after the U.S. pullout, Afghanistan is still bogged down in turmoil. The country has been the scene of recurrent terrorist attacks, some of which have been claimed by the Daesh terrorist group. Iran says the U.S. has resorted to Daesh to wage a proxy war in Afghanistan to make up for its losses.
The U.S. continues to back terrorists such as Daesh to destabilize Afghanistan. Aside from Daesh, it has been hosting some 7,000 Afghan military forces from the previous Afghan army to train them. What's the goal of such military trainings?
Since the Taliban takeover, Iran has been calling for an all-inclusive government in Afghanistan as the ultimate way out of the persisting instability in the war-torn country.
Experts here describe the U.S. withdrawal from Afghanistan a lasting shame for America and the worst fiasco after its loss in the 1950s Vietnam War. They say the chaotic exit is also a lesson for the region that wherever Washington has set foot, it has left nothing but mess and destruction for the hosting nations. Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
Diplomats from the European Union, including heads of European diplomatic missions in the occupied West Bank and Al-Quds, arrived in Gaza Tuesday morning. The senior European officials toured the Shati refugee camp upon arriving in the blockaded territory. Their short visit comes less than 2 weeks after the Israeli regime launched a three-day military aggression on Gaza that claimed the lives of 49 people, including 17 children.
We come here only 10 days after the ceasefire has been agreed. A ceasefire which gave end to 3 days of terrible fighting, where far too many civilians, far too many children and women lost their lives. It's also to show solidarity to the Gazans in general, but also to the kids, the children who lost their lives, who were injured.
The ambassadors of the European Union made an inspection tour of the wounded during the recent Israeli aggression at Gaza's Shifa Hospital.
We briefed the European delegation on the humanitarian situation in Gaza and the dire condition of hospitals. The delegation also visited the patients and those who were injured during the recent Israeli military aggression. We also told them about the lack of medicines and hospital supplies because of the Israeli blockade.
The brief visit by the European diplomats comes at a time when the people of Gaza are suffering under a tight Israeli blockade that has been in place since 2007. Most Gazans rely on handouts to survive, and many of them are unemployed.
It's clear that many more people many more people fell below the poverty line. Unemployment rate has significantly increased. Health and education problems have become even more problematic.
Palestinians and human rights groups have repeatedly slammed the European countries for their failure to take an action aimed at ending Israeli violations against the besieged territory.
Many here believe that the visit by the European diplomats will not improve the situation for the people of Gaza, given Israel's impunity and the failure of the international community to hold the regime accountable for its crimes. Ashraf Shanan, Gaza.
Mid-August this year marked the one-year anniversary of the Taliban takeover of Afghanistan and the U.S. massive withdrawal from the country, after 2 decades of military presence. The last year U.S.-led evacuation turned violent and tragic, during which many Afghan people lost their lives. Sports champion Muhammad John, who was shot dead at the Kabul airport, was one of the victims. His parents blamed the U.S. for the tragic incident and are seeking compensation for the loss of their boy.
The U.S. and its allies are 100% to blame for the martyrdom of our beloved ones at the airport because they invited people and gave them hope of getting them out of Afghanistan. The U.S. not only did not provide the people with security, but also opened fire on them. They killed and injured at least 400 people, including my son. We are waiting for compensation from those who committed the crime.
The U.S. 2-decade invasion of Afghanistan ended with the withdrawal of the last U.S. troops from Kabul last year. However, Afghans say Washington has started another war against them, a dangerous economic war. Since the Taliban's return to power on August 15, 2021, the U.S. has frozen nearly $9 billion in Afghanistan foreign reserves and cut off major international funding. The sanctions have pushed Afghanistan's economy to the brink of collapse, with 97% of Afghans live in poverty. Afghan people and international bodies have been calling for the release of funds so that the country could cope with the ongoing humanitarian crisis.
The impacts of the U.S. seizure of Afghan assets have not been less than the damages of their 20-year war. When the U.S. sanctions were imposed on Afghanistan, the fragile economy started to shrink. Banking system crashed and people went out of cash. The money they had on their hands lost its value. Today, 1 year on, the conditions are deepening, so the U.S. and the international communities are obliged to unfreeze the assets and let the flow of aid to the country.
Meanwhile, violence and bloodshed have continued under the Taliban. The country saw a rise in deadly attacks against the Shia community last year, mostly carried out by the Daesh terrorist group. 1 year into the Taliban's return to power, Afghans are still grappling with multiple crises. However, they are happy that the U.S. occupation of their country has ended. Rahmatullah Baghban, Kabul.
The last French soldiers have left Mali after being expelled by Bamako following 9 years of unpopular war, which has left Mali one of the poorest countries in the world. 2.5 million refugees have been created, thousands of civilians were killed, and the politicians who initially colluded with Paris, widely accused of corruption, were ousted by popular anti-French protests in 2020.
Malians have been dying for 9 years. Things have only gotten worse. It has spread to Niger, Burkina Faso, Mauritania, and elsewhere. After 9 years, this hasn't worked, and Malians want results. However, when Malians made their revolution, France criticized and opposed it.
The roots of the Mali conflict run deep, but they all feature French aggression. In 2011, Nicolas Sarkozy illegally dropped 40 tons of arms to help overthrow the Socialist People's Libyan Arab Republic led by Muammar Gaddafi. Those arms spread to northern Mali, where the nomadic Tuaregs used them in their conflict with southern Mali, which has existed ever since imperialist France drew Mali's irregular bowtie-shaped borders. Paris alleged the Tuaregs were religious radicals, and in 2013, François Hollande invaded Mali, prior to receiving the approval of the United Nations. Many allege that uranium deposits, which keep French nuclear power cheap, gold mines, and the desire to maintain the neo-colonial system known as France-Afrique were the primary motivations for a war which would be dubbed France's Afghanistan.
Many of France's former colonies gained their independence in the 1950s, but since 1960, France has had more than 50 military interventions in Africa.
France has been completely wrong about so many things, and especially the times we now live in. This is a multipolar world, and neocolonialism has failed. Africa no longer wants France and the West as their only ally and as their tutors. Africa has changed, and we will choose our own partners and our own destiny.
The war killed 59 French soldiers, but French imperialism in Mali was cited repeatedly as justification in terror attacks in France, which cost hundreds of lives. Ramin Mazahiri, Paris.
Join us in this journey. This is the Heart of Life Pounding. IRIB English Radio.
In the limelight.
The U.S. government's Indo-Pacific Strategy Report 2019 claims that China uses economic inducements and penalties to persuade other countries to comply with its Belt and Road Initiative. We now present you an article written by Vijay Prashad, an Indian historian, editor and journalist. The piece is titled U.S. Makes Another Stab at Challenging China's Belt and Road Initiative. The article was published by the Asia Times. At the Group of Seven summit in Germany on 26th of June, U.S. President Joe Biden made a pledge to raise $200 billion within the United States for global infrastructure spending. It was made clear that this new G7 project, the Partnership for Global Infrastructure and Investment, or PGII, was intended to counter the Chinese Belt and Road Initiative, BRI. Given Joe Biden's failure to pass the Build Back Better bill, with its scope being almost halved from $3.5 trillion to $2.2 trillion, it is unlikely that he will get the U.S. Congress to go along with this new endeavor. The Partnership for Global Infrastructure and Investment is not the first attempt by the U.S. to match Chinese infrastructure investment globally, which initially took place bilaterally and then, after 2013, happened through the Belt and Road Initiative. In 2004, as the U.S. war on Iraq unfolded, the U.S. government set up a body called the Millennium Challenge Corporation, which it called an independent U.S. Foreign Assistance Agency. Before that, most U.S. government development lending was done through the United States Agency for International Development, or USAID, which was set up in 1961 as part of President John F. Kennedy's administration's campaign against the Soviet Union and against the Bandung spirit of non-alignment in the newly assertive Third World. Former President George W. Bush said U.S. aid was too bureaucratic, and so the Millennium Challenge Corporation would be a project that would include both the US government and the private sector. The word corporation in the title is deliberate. Each of the heads of the Millennium Challenge Corporation, from Paul Applegarth to Alice Albright, has belonged to the private sector. The current head, Albright, is the daughter of the late US Secretary of State, Madeleine Albright. The word challenge in the Millennium Challenge Corporation refers to the fact that the grants are only approved if the countries can show that they meet 20 policy performance indicators, ranging from civil liberties to inflation rates. These indicators ensure that the countries seeking the grants adhere to the conventional new liberal framework. There are also great inconsistencies among these indicators. For instance, the countries must have a high immunization rate, monitored by the World Health Organization, WHO, but at the same time they must follow the International Monetary Fund's requirements for a tight fiscal policy. This in essence means the public health spending of a candidate country should be kept low, resulting in the required number of public health workers not being available for the immunization programs. As a US government official told me in 2022, the US Congress provided $650 million to the Millennium Challenge Corporation. For its first year in 2004, the amount sought was more than $900 million. In 2007, when former US President George W. Bush met with Nambarin Enkhbayar, the former president of Mongolia, to sign a Millennium Challenge Corporation grant, he claimed the Millennium Challenge account, which is administered by the Millennium Challenge Corporation, is an important part of our foreign policy. It's an opportunity for the United States and other taxpayers to help countries that fight corruption, that support market-based economies, and that invest in the health and education of their people. Clearly, the Millennium Challenge Corporation is an instrument of US foreign policy, but its aim seems to be not so much to tackle the sustainable development goals of the United Nations on hunger, health and education, as George W. Bush claimed, but to ensure extension of the reach of US influence and to inculcate the habits and structures of US-led globalization or market-based economies. In 2009, then-US President Barack Obama developed a pivot to Asia, a new foreign policy orientation that had the US establishment focus more attention on East and South Asia. As part of this pivot, in 2011, the then-Secretary of State Hillary Clinton gave an important speech in Chennai, India, where she spoke about the creation of a new Silk Road Initiative. Hillary Clinton argued that the US government, under Barack Obama's pivot to Asia policy, was going to develop an economic agenda that ran from the Central Asian countries to South India and would thereby help integrate the Central Asian republics into a US project and break the ties the region had formed with Russia and China. The impetus for the new Silk Road was to find a way to use this development as an instrument to purportedly undermine the Taliban operations in Afghanistan. This US project foundered because of lack of congressional funding and because of its sheer impossibility, since Afghanistan, which was at the heart of this road project, could not be persuaded to submit to US interests. Just 2 years later, in 2013, the Chinese government inaugurated the Silk Road Economic Belt Project, which is now known as the Belt and Road Initiative. Rather than go from north to south, the Belt and Road Initiative went from east to west. linking China to Central Asia and then outward to South Asia, West Asia, Europe, Africa and beyond. The aim of this project was to bring together Eurasian Economic Community, established in 2000, and the Shanghai Cooperation Organization, which was set up in 2001, to work on this new, bigger project. Roughly $4 trillion has been invested since 2013 in a range of projects by the Belt and Road Initiative and its associated funding mechanisms, including the Asian Infrastructure Investment Bank and the Silk Road Fund. The investments were paid for by grants from Chinese institutions and through debt incurred by the projects at rates that are competitive with those of Western infrastructure lending programs. The US government's Indo-Pacific Strategy Report 2019 claims that China uses economic inducements and penalties to persuade other countries to comply with its agenda. The report provides no evidence, though, and indeed scholars who have looked into these matters do not see any such evidence. US Admiral Philip Davidson, who previously commanded the Indo-Pacific Command, claimed in Congress that China was leveraging its economic instrument of power in Asia. The Millennium Challenge Corporation and other instruments, including a new International Development Finance Corporation, were hastily set up to give America an edge over China in a US-driven contest over the creation of infrastructure investment globally. There is no doubt that the Millennium Challenge Corporation is part of a broad Indo-Pacific strategy of the United States to undermine Chinese influence in Asia. Only a handful of countries have thus far received MCC grants, saying, starting with Honduras and with Madagascar. These are often not very large grants, although US officials claimed for a country the size of Malawi or Jordan, they can have a considerable impact. No large countries have been drawn into the Millennium Challenge Corporation's compact, which suggests that the United States wants to give these grants to mainly smaller countries to strengthen their ties with the United States. Nepal's accession to the Millennium Challenge Corporation must be seen in this broader context, although the discovery of uranium in Nepal's Upper Mustang region in 2014 seems to play an important role in the pressure campaign on that country. In May of 2017, Nepal's government signed a Belt and Road Initiative Framework Agreement, which included a plan to build a railway link between China and Nepal through the Himalayas. The rail link would allow Nepal to lessen its reliance on Indian land routes for trade purposes. Various projects began to be discussed and feasibility studies were commissioned under the Belt and Road Initiative plan. These projects, more details for which emerged in 2019, were the extension of an electricity transmission line and the creation of a technical university in Nepal, and of course, construction of a vast network of roads and rail, which included the Trans-Himalayan Railway from Keirung to Kathmandu. During this time, the United States entered the picture with a full-scale effort to disparage the Belt and Road Initiative funding in Nepal and to promote the use of Millennium Challenge Corporation's money there instead. Under US pressure in September of 2017, the government of Nepal signed an agreement with the United States called the Nepal Compact. This agreement, worth $500 million, is for an electricity transmission project and for a road maintenance project. After both deals had been signed, a political dispute broke out in Nepal, which resulted in the split of the Communist Party of Nepal and the fall of the leftist government. One major issue on the table was the Millennium Challenge Corporation and its role in the overall Indo-Pacific strategy of the United States, which seems to be targeted against China.
Joining us now from Ontario, Canada.
Now back to our story.
What is it in there?
We will be talking about this.
Let me bring in Leo Sazdi. He's a professor of international.
The Spotlight.
Welcome. Now, recent developments in talks regarding the revival of the 2015 Iran deal have offered a glimmer of optimism that a deal may actually be agreed upon. Just before midnight on Monday, Iran sent its promised response to what the European Union has called a final text of an agreement to restore the deal, the nuclear deal, also known as the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action, or the JCPOA. Reports indicate that although Iran's response was not a complete yes, but it has made no significant objections and instead seeks more clarifications. In this edition of Spotlight, we will be discussing the different aspects of the revival talks and how Iran can make sure that the assurances offered in the new deal and the lifting of sanctions would still stand if Joe Biden leaves office. To discuss that further, we're joined by political analyst Sayed Mustafa Khoshcheshm. And also journalist and activist and political analyst John Bosnich.
This is The Spotlight. The Spotlight takes an in-depth look at the headlines, featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to The Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio.
Thank you very much to both of you gentlemen for joining us on this edition. Mr. Khoshchesh, as far as we know, there are three main sticking points that remain. There's a verifiable removal of sanctions, the guarantees that a deal will be binding regardless of a future U.S. administration, and, of course, the long-running investigation by the IAEA instigated by Israel. And Iran wants that to be dropped. Of course, Iran says that these are not really big issues for the U.S. to solve. So, in your opinion, let's begin with the first one, which is a verifiable removal of sanctions. What are some guarantees that the U.S. can give about the removal of sanctions, and how can Iran make sure that those sanctions have actually been lifted?
Hello, and thanks for having me. Well, there is a detailed mechanism for doing so. You know, verification is a complicated process. It takes time because according to the U.S. sanctions, Iranian oil sector is under sanctions. So contracts with foreign parties are already under sanctions. The shipping, the Iranian shipping industries, the ships, the ports, the different types of insurances that are provided to the Iranian shipping industries, including the PNI, the pollution and indemnity insurances that are provided by mostly some 95% of them are provided by Lloyd's Insurance Company in London and other insurance companies in London, and also sending the money back to Iran, the banking ties, they are all under sanctions. So if you want to verify removal of sanctions, then you need a span of time, weeks or months, because it's not just one cargo. Iran should be able to, sell oil, to load the cargo, the ships, the insurance, the banking ties, the money should be wired back to Iran. So it takes time. And the question might be why this kind of sequencing is has been demanded by Iran, because the last time we did when the JCPOA went into action, Iran was the party that conducted all its, undertakings. And then the Americans started and they, shrank their part and they avoided doing their undertakings. So they showed a deceitful behavior. So the party that has left the deal is the Americans, very illegally, of course, even without resorting to the mechanisms that are already in the JCPOA. They didn't do that. So this time they need to provide the verifications. But the problem falls in the assurance, the area of the guarantees. This is very important. There's a checklist of guarantees.
Since you explained the reason for Iran's tough position on the JCPOA, basically the revival talks altogether, I would like to cut you off right there. Hold that thought, because we're coming back to this point. But let's bring in our guest from Belgrade, Mr. John Bosnich. Mr. Bosnich, the excessive demands of the United States is basically the reason for Iran's tough stance on the revival talks. How justified do you believe this is, considering what our other guest from Tehran, Mr. Khoshchashm, just explained?
Well, I respect your comments of your other guest, because he's speaking in good faith and referring to the actual deals and offers being made on the table. But I have to speak from experience as a former government advisor in Japan, in Canada, political candidates in the United States and here in Europe, that the standard procedure of the United States is to try to make offers that bring the other party into a situation where the United States can claim, honestly or not, that there's been a violation. And the United States typically tries to accelerate and enhance these claims of violations to create what they call a casus belli, which means the reason for a war. So I recognize that Iran's position on this matter has been in good faith and straight up, but I'm deeply concerned that the United States may be attempting to draw Iran into a situation where it can make a fake claim to cause a conflict. That's the main concern that I have as a former government advisor in the West and now in Europe.
And Mr. Khoshchashm, that definitely explains why Iran is being so tough this time around coming to the negotiating table, doesn't it?
Yeah, Iran has sustained billions or tens of or hundreds of billions of dollars in damage because of the U.S. withdrawal from the deal. Iran stood loyal to the deal for 14 months after the U.S. Discarded the deal. And Europeans were made the promises, but they never made their part. They never held up their end of the bargain. And they just made wars, spoke about, their future compliance. But they never did that because they don't do anything against the United States. But this time, Iran wants guarantees that this is not going to happen. Because when you oxidize oxidate, I don't know which one is the better word, uranium, which is kind of metal, then you may not revive it. You may not bring it back to life. It's gone is gone. Cannot be brought back to life again and be useful and effective again. When you dismantle your centrifuge machines and done is done, cannot be undone. They are, nuclear industries are very, expensive high tech. So Iran has sustained the damage, a lot of damage. Now, there have been many Iranian patients that have lost their lives, especially those with rare diseases, kids with butterfly diseases. Now, because the U.S. reimposed the sanctions on its banking sector, now we need to have guarantees. And let me tell you this, One of the European officials in the latest round of talks, one of the top European leaders, made a couple of promises that we will resolve this because they need oil and energy supplies. So they want to, you know, satisfy Iran, convince Iran that, okay, go for a deal. But let's be honest. We've experienced this before. When the JCPOA was being signed, John Kerry made 1,000 verbal promises to Mr. Zeri. And you may not be deceived again, you know, especially not with this government and this new team. I mean, we have the experience. We know that verbal promises are good for nothing. So one of the main bones of contention right now is that we are asking them, okay, you said there will be verbal promises. All right, do it in written. I mean, give us your written promises and guarantees. And they resist. And the question is, why? If you are really honest, why are you resisting? Why are you not doing what you said already? I mean, less than a month ago or 2 months ago. And if there is a third area of guarantees that's in between, and it's the main bone of contention standing between the two sides, you know, there are different types of guarantees. When we talk about guarantees, people think that it's just the Congress approval. No, Congress, Biden, Blinken, they just, they can provide the political guarantee. And who cares for the signature of the United States when they already violated the same deal? They don't care about it. It's not just the JCPOA. They violated at the same time, at around the same time. They violated the Paris Climate Accord, NAFTA, Transatlantic, the tariff agreement with China, and they escalated into war. And then Open Skies Treaty, also the IMF, the short-range ballistic, nuclear-capable ballistic missiles with Russia. So as you see, and they even withdrew their membership from UNESCO. UNESCO, some of them had congressional approvals, some not. In just a very short span of time, they discarded everything and started renegotiation with friends, Europeans, Mexicans, Canadians. They were forced to, you know, appease Donald Trump, but the Russians, the Chinese, the Iranians, they are enemies, they are rivals, and they didn't agree to give up their sovereignty and independence because they were right. And the one who violated the deal was the United States and not just Donald Trump. Now, what we want is very strong guarantees. There is a checklist. The guarantee is not just the word. And I'll explain it later, maybe after my colleague speaks, because I'm
exactly, Mr. Khoshesham. That's the point I wanted to raise right now. We will be discussing what these guarantees can be according to a checklist that you mentioned, and also a list of things that came to my mind as I was taking notes. So we will discuss how the U.S. can give us those guarantees. But let's bring back Mr. Bosnich to see. You mentioned yourself, Iran is taking part in these negotiations in a good gesture, actually. It's trying to make a positive gesture on international level. Personally, you've had the experience and you know that it's not necessarily true about the United States. In this case, and at the point that we've reached right now regarding the revival of the nuclear deal, do you believe that the U.S. is willing to give the necessary guarantees, which we will discuss later, in order to for Iran to be sure that this deal will stand?
Well, I think that everything is possible, and I believe that Iran has taken a very correct legal approach on this entire matter. The fact that Iran has had for some continuation of time continued to abide by the deal, even though the deal had been canceled unilaterally by the United States, is already a show of good faith on the part of Iran. Secondary, I think the insistence from your other contributor today's program is that any deal must be in writing. every detail of the deal must be specified clearly down to the statistical data that they might be requesting, and there must be external guarantors. And when I say external, I mean external to the U.S. empire. Having the contact group from a European countries is not really an external guarantor, because those countries in the EU are little more than American military colonies. Their security depends on the United States. The United States helped form the EU, and the United States pressures those countries to say and do as it says. What might be beneficial to Iran in this case is to go forward in good faith, get a very detailed written agreement that is signed and is certified by the United Nations, and then request Russia or China or both to become monitors on the compliance of the deal and bring that in from the Iranian side. Then you've got a deal that has external parties that have great international weight, and that they can be performing the function of neutral monitors. And you then have some balance in the agreement, and where there is balance and where there is some sort of countervailing power against the overwhelming power of America, you may be able to achieve a deal. Nothing is impossible if you go into it with a clean heart and an open willingness to cooperate.
Okay, so Mr. Khoshchesh, let's go through that checklist of yours and see what are some guarantees that the U.S. can give Iran. What are some steps that it can take to make sure that even if a deal is dropped, Iran will not suffer as much damage as it did last time?
Basically speaking, we have two different types of guarantees, roughly similar to what my colleague said. Some of the guarantees totally depend on the U.S. or Europeans' good faith and their responsibility, if they are ever responsible and care for their own signature, no matter what type of guarantees we're talking about. And there is another type that's not in their hands. It's in Iran's hands. Now, what are we talking about? There are different types of guarantees, like the United States president, puts his signature down, and or Mr. Blinken, as Secretary of State, confirms in written or approves and gives his words in written, or the Congress. These are called political guarantees. Yes, they are needed, of course, but nobody cares about, U.S. responsibility, because they have already proved to be very much irresponsible. They don't, keep their words, as I said. It's not just in the JCPOA, the nuclear deal with Iran, but they have violated, discarded nearly a dozen other agreements at roughly around the same time, just a couple of years ago, three, 4 years ago. Now, there's another type that's called legal guarantees. When the Amaro sanctions started as the first U.S. extraterritorial, sanctions rule, the Europeans warned their companies that if they comply with the Americans' rules, extraterritorial rules, that means they are disrespecting their own sovereignty, their own country's sovereignty. So they warned them, if you pursue their own policy, then we will fine you as much as the Americans would do. But if you stand against the United States, then we will make up for your losses. And they stood against sanctions on Cuba. We've been asking them since last year, why don't you do that with regard to Iran? This is there are legal mechanisms like this that you can do it. And they've been resisting, and they've not been doing anything. That's why we are suspecting their true intentions. Another type is economic guarantees. European firms, Asian firms, they are demanding us that even if the United States provides you with other types of guarantees, we are not, sure about the Americans, because they are very much irresponsible. They would tear up the deal maybe in a few months when the Republicans take the House and, the Congress. So we need guarantees to allow us to stay in Iran after doing the investment for a long period of time without being punished, even if the U.S. discards the deal, even if the JCPOA is gone, no matter what happens. This is very important. And also, This has been one of the bones of contention. But the only type that you can trust and rely and has a deterrent factor is the one that's in Iran's hand. What is it? It's the nuclear guarantees. That is to say, I'm going to keep my machines, of course, in store under the surveillance of the IAEA. They will not operate, but they will be stored, but on my own soil. I would keep my knowledge, R&D. I would keep my material. They all, you know, will be under the inspection of the IAEA according to the deal. Why? Because if you discard the deal again, I would not sustain any kind of damage, financial, technological damage. Second, that would play as a deterrent factor against the United States. They know that if they drop the deal, if they ever sign it, then they can, Iran can resume its 60% enrichment operation and maybe beyond. That's a deterrent factor. So there are many more types of guarantees, like if European start, billions of dollars of investment in Iran in order to, you know, make it very much complicated for the United States to punish their own companies and encourage their own companies to come to the Iranian market. So they can also do lots of other things, but they are resisting. This is the problem. You have given us your verbal words. You have agreed that it should be made very much difficult for the United States to do the same that they did just a few years ago.
Mr. Khoshesh, you mentioned many very important factors that could serve as guarantees for Iran, particularly the last one and the fact that Iran's enriched uranium is now at 60% enrichment. And basically, we have only time for only one question I'd like to ask Mr. Bosnich. Some observers say that we are getting close to a now or never situation. To what extent do you agree?
Well, in a sense, Iran has done everything possible while maintaining its national sovereignty to come to a peaceful deal on the JCPOA. Iran has bent over backwards. It has had the deal canceled unilaterally from the other side. And not only did the other side unilaterally cancel it, they're continuing to blame Iran. Iran has to simply say, this is it. This is the last time we will deal with you. We are going to sign a contract, it will be certified with the United Nations, and we will bring in external monitors to monitor your monitors and our monitors, and then it's up. If you don't comply with this, it means you don't want a deal, no matter how we've tried. And that's what I would suggest that Iran should do.
Thank you very much, journalist, activist, and political analyst John Bosnich from Belgrade, and political analyst Said Mustafa